These are tough days for Central Asian human rights activists, journalists, and those who defend freedom of press and expression and rule of law in the region. It has never been easy, but it is getting even tougher recently. The harassment of journalists of the only independent media, the Turkmen Service of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, have increased in Turkmenistan recently. There is already no independent NGOs in the country. Originally speaking, several Uzbek human rights activists have been recently detained. Restrictions on religious freedom is on the rise in Tajikistan, so does in Uzbekistan. Kazakh and Kyrgyz societies are facing challenges of their own. These actions are taking place at a time when the top international diplomat, the Secretary General of the United Nations, Ban Ki-moon, is visiting Central Asia, also ahead of EU-Turkmenistan annual human rights dialogue. Today, we will discuss some of these pressing human and universal rights issues in Central Asia, why pressure against independent journalists and activists are intensifying, what are the elements contributing to this. To discuss these questions from Bishkek, we have Steve Svirtlo, who is the Human Rights Watch Central Asia Director, Johan Beer, Central Asia Director of Reporters Without Borders, Bruce Panier, Editor of Central Asia blog at Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty called Kishlak Owazi, and Bradley James Jardin, Central Asia Researcher at Glasgow University. I am Mohammed Tahir, Director of Turkmenistan Service at Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty. Welcome, gentlemen, to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Let's begin with highlighting some of the general pressing issues of today involving those topics that I have just mentioned. Bruce, taking the home advantage, I would say, why not you grab the microphone and tell us what's happening, especially in Turkmenistan lately?
Well, you know, Turkmenistan was never a very friendly environment for rights activists and journalists to begin with. There seems to be a growing paranoia on the part of the government. It's unclear exactly why this is true, although it could stem from economic problems. It could also stem from the perceived threat, security threat from south of the border in Afghanistan, too. But they have been certainly paying a little extra attention. And boy, is that ever a relative term, because they're always pretty focused on these any groups that could possibly cause any kind of social unrest. But, you know, despite all that, we actually have seen, or at least we get information about some kind of social disruptions, I guess I'll say, that have happened in Turkmenistan recently. We had this mysterious protest in Tejen in February, where at first they arrested 9 people, and then the later reports, and we can't confirm any of this because we can't get anyone out there, but it seemed like more like 50 or 60 people were actually taken into custody. Various reasons were given. Some reports link these people to Islamic extremist groups, but others, more credibly, said it was a result of deteriorating social conditions and had to do with the devaluation of the local currency and the inability of the local population to buy basic goods. And then, amazingly, we saw an oil workers' strike in Lavap, which was the first strike in Turkmenistan. Well, it's certainly the first organized social protest since 1995, so it's like 20 years. So, you know, all of a sudden, Turkmen government, maybe for those reasons, for reasons that we can't see because of the opaque nature of that government, has decided to put a new focus on making sure that anyone who wants to voice discontent is kept quiet as quickly as possible. And we've just seen this with our own correspondent. You know, Turkmenistan's obviously the worst case example, but I would say that this is kind of a general trend across Central Asia these days, where there's really been not exactly a crackdown, but they're certainly tightening restrictions on social groups and independent media if and where it exists within Central Asia.
Talking about Turkmenistan, since new leader is in power, the intimidation methods of the authorities have also changed lately. They avoid a confrontational approach by putting journalists in jail, but they visit them immediately after their reports are aired or published, intimidate them with various threats, saying that they will find ways to punish them. Sometime, like it happened a few days ago, they could take a reporter and put them in a hall and conduct even a Maoist-style court hearing where the reporter was publicly warned and disgraced in a gathering of local government representatives. Telephone lines of our reporters are cut off recently. These are long lines, as Bruce, you just mentioned. Reporters are harassed for their routine work, for reports like long queues in front of butcher shops and money exchange centers. The authorities continue to say our activities are illegal, but in the meantime, they also ignore our messages for engaging in a dialogue for accreditation of our reporters. So it's very hard to understand, as Bruce, you said, the intention of Turkmen government and the paranoia behind it. Johan, your focus is obviously media freedom. We understand ranking of some of Central Asian countries, especially Turkmenistan, has not improved with obvious reasons. So far, we have been talking about Turkmenistan. What are some of the recent highlights in rest of the Central Asia in terms of restriction of freedom of media? Obviously, Turkmenistan also in rest of Central Asia.
As you mentioned, unfortunately, the press freedom records of, well, nearly all Central Asian countries is far from improving, and Turkmenistan still lies at the 178th position out of 180 countries in the world, which is, well, dismal to say the least. Out of recent developments across the region, one can mention, for instance, nearly 2-week-long internet blockade in Tajikistan, which targeted all major social networks, including YouTube, Odnoklassniki, Vkontakte, and others. And during several days, most independent news websites, following the news of a very top security forces official joining the ranks of the Islamic State in Syria. So this is very telling, as per the habit in Central Asia to kill the messenger rather than to tackle the problem. Actually, Tajikistan definitely have an issue with Islamic State recruits, but just when a video gets online of this top official joining the ranks of the Islamic State, the first answer of the authorities is to close as many websites as possible, which is obviously not helping, and which can only increase the lack of confidence of the population in the mainstream media, in its own government, etc. This trend has been on the rise across Central Asia, internet censorship, I mean, and it has been more and more obvious. Nearly all the Central Asia states have adopted laws allowing the authorities to filter internet websites without any court decision. It's not the case yet in Kyrgyzstan only, but a bill has been submitted last month to the parliament in this direction. So it's still a draft law, it's still a bill, but in all the other countries it's already usual practice. In Kazakhstan last year, the authorities have even taken a more draconian step by allowing the authorities to cut off any communication network at will, without any court order. So we are coming to really extreme ways of censorship, which are now a habit across the region, unfortunately.
Thank you, Johan. Colleagues, please feel free to pose questions to each other, interrupt and engage each other, that we have a fluent discussion. Steve, it's been long discussion on media freedom in Central Asia, deservingly, I believe, especially Turkmenistan. But the media is the only one aspect of many rights problem in those countries, in the rest of the region. As a human rights organization, constantly you follow situation in totality. Take us through some of the other challenges that the civic society is faced with in Central Asia recently.
Thanks. I mean, the list is long and growing longer, as Bruce and Johan have said. You know, some of the most serious concerns, I think, you know, a lot of them can be sort of encompassed under the rubric of freedom of expression. You know, a lot of what we're talking about, media freedom, and the other sort of aspects of freedom of expression are the right of association, assembly, and we've seen the space, for example, in Kazakhstan over the past 5 years, dramatically reducing the right to protest, to demonstrate peacefully. We've seen, you know, across the whole region, as Johan already alluded to, there's been a real crackdown on civil society on a whole variety of levels. We've seen the Islamic Revival Party, for the first time in Tajikistan's modern history, not get a seat in parliament. This is a real decline in the sort of democratic credentials of modern Tajikistan. We've seen a targeted campaign of harassment against many members of of both the political opposition and civil society at large. We saw, you know, some of the longest sentences in Tajikistan's history being doled out in the last year in what we consider to be very politically motivated cases. For example, Zaid Saidov, a businessman from Tajikistan, who announced an interest in running for president and formed a new party prior to the presidential elections in 2013, he was put away for actually 26 years, an extremely long, for Tajikistan, really long prison sentence. And it really signaled, I think, a shift towards a much harder crackdown there, which puts Tajikistan more in a category with the Uzbekistans and Turkmenistans of the region. To dwell on Tajikistan a little bit more, you mentioned the restrictions on religion. We've seen there some of the world's most restrictive laws on religion. So, for example, the parental responsibility law, which prevents minors, anyone under the age of 18, attending a mosque, a church, a synagogue, even with the accompaniment of a parent. Those are quite extreme measures that violate the freedom of the exercise of one's worship and conscience. And the restrictions on religion are something we see in Kyrgyzstan, we see in Kazakhstan, the consideration of a very restrictive law. Uzbekistan, of course, paved the way for that practice when it passed its religion law in 1997. And it has continued its campaign year after year of, we estimate, you know, maybe 200 or 300 on average arrests of so-called independent Muslims, people that practice their religion outside of extremely strict rules set by the state. That means worshiping in one's home or worshiping in a small group of people, discussing religion in an unsanctioned place, wearing a beard, wearing a hijab, carrying a Bible which is not registered. There are a whole myriad of violations, but that whole legal framework in Uzbekistan has allowed for a very large population of people to be targeted. So, you know, we've estimated at Human Rights Watch, perhaps there being, you know, there being certainly thousands of political prisoners, people held on politically motivated charges, most of them being related to religion. And some of the groups inside the country put it at an even higher figure, over 10,000, 12,000. And, of course, in that category, I guess I would say Uzbekistan is leading in terms of political prisoners. You know, in Kyrgyzstan, turning back to some of the other concerns, you know, we're here now in June 2015, 5 years after the OSHA events, and we've still seen a systematic failure by the Kyrgyz authorities to address the egregious abuses that occurred, the violence which disproportionately targeted ethnic Uzbeks, and yet the vast majority of criminal cases that have been opened in connection with the OSHA events were with Uzbek defendants. That legacy has not really been addressed and continues to haunt this country. And, you know, those are just a few of the concerns. I could keep going.
Right, right. Bradley, you have been looking at the violation of labor codes in some of the Central Asian countries lately. It's obviously another problematic aspect in the region. Tell us what you were able to get together.
Yes, I mean, interestingly, I mean, as the Central Asian economies begin to feel the squeeze, I wonder what kind of impact this will have on, you know, labor rights in Central Asia, which are already atrocious. We've already seen with Turkmenistan how there's unrest among oil workers. Mm. I mean, that's already showing some signs there. You know, you've got at the one extreme, you've got Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan that have forced labor picking on the cotton fields, where they take children 15 to 17 out of schools basically for 3 months of the year for very minimal pay to fulfill government quotas. Also having Kazakhstan, you know, like in 2011, there was unrest among the oil workers there. You know, Kazakhstan also has further restrictions on assembly for labor unions. You know, there's criminal sanctions against workers who continue strikes that are declared illegal by the courts. I mean, on top of that, you know, Kazakhstan also harasses a lot of labor activists. And even imprisons many of them.
Bruce, taking into account all of these accounts and incidents that you have mentioned and other guests have mentioned, it's easy to conclude that things are not getting better. So we are faced with further setback in the region. Is this correct conclusion?
Though I would agree with that 100%. You know, with the possible exception of Kyrgyzstan, and Kyrgyzstan is always an exception in Central Asia, but, you know, I think that this, what's happening now reflects to a great extent the paranoia on the part of some of these governments. You know, we've had Berdimuhamedov is a relative newcomer to Central Asia, but certainly Rahman, Nazarbayev, and Karimov have been in for a long time. And in all that time, they've never really managed to gain anything like popular support. I mean, they have to be aware on some level that the people really aren't behind them. And the response is instead of to try to figure out some way that they can get the population with them, you know, by for instance, you know, giving them some of these rights, which really wouldn't hurt in a lot of, you know, independent media has not really been the reason that Kyrgyz governments have been overthrown, for instance. So you should be able to let some independent media in, and it shouldn't be harmful. There's room for different opinions in the countries, but they don't view it that way. You know, instead they keep working to silence any dissent, any signs of dissatisfaction with their government. I mean, you know, this, it sounds like something a politician would say, but it's a sign of weakness that, you know, they really don't have the people behind them, and the only answer they can come up with again and again is to make sure that people don't have an opportunity to say or do anything to publicly show that they're dissatisfied with the way their country is being run. Potentially, this leads to a huge number of problems in the future, especially in the case of Nazarbayev and Karimov, who are probably not going to be with us too much longer, both well into their 70s, Karimov coming up on 80. You know, so they've laid the groundwork for instability in the future, and it's kind of a shame because, you know, I think everyone here certainly would agree, and some of the people at this roundtable have made the point that In a fair election, for instance, Nazarbayev would probably win, and Karimov would probably win. So there's no harm in letting an opposition candidate, a true, genuine opposition candidate, run. There's no harm in letting an independent media network say, you know, there's some policies of the government that we don't agree with. You know, because certainly they must be aware that some of the policies are not working very well. Why is there a problem with right to assembly in some of these countries? You know, if the government has a strong case for why the politics are the way they are, they should be able to argue logically, you know, we hear what you're saying, and this is why we're doing what we're doing. But instead, the answer time and time again is, we don't want to hear it, you don't understand, and we don't, you know, we have no respect for your opinion. You know, I've made the point, too, in other talks that the constitutions of all these countries are beautifully written, and they were written in, you know, in conjunction with people from Europe and the United States, and they're just routinely ignored time and time again. You can point to actions by the governments that are in direct conflict with the Constitution over and over again. And like I said, as far as I'm concerned, it just seems to set the table for problems, you know, 5-10 years down the road.
Right. The question of why, you spoke about it in a length, but before to come into that, I want to go to Bishkek and also Paris. Are you guys in agreement with us that there are setbacks recently in Central Asia in areas that you have been involved in? Let's go with Paris first.
Yeah, sure. It's impossible not to agree with this sad remarks. Unfortunately, the situation has been terrible. The human rights, press freedom records has been terrible since the independence of these republics. Right. And the previous situation remains unchanged. For instance, you still have a huge number of political prisoners, including 9 journalists in jail in Uzbekistan, which remained routinely tortured. I can only mention, for instance, the case of Muhammad Bekjanov, who has been in jail since 1999. And who has lost part of his earring, many teeth, he has a groin hernia, and all this because he used to be the editor-in-chief of the main opposition newspaper in the early 90s. So all these old problems, they remain, but in addition, they are further aggravated by the succession issue, as mentioned by Bruce, and also by the aftermath of the Ukrainian crisis, both in the political and the economic factors. So obviously, by crushing and crushing and crushing on dissent, these governments only nurture the appeal of Islamist insurgents, of armed undergrounds. And I totally agree, unfortunately, on the fact that this is a kind of a suicidal policy for these governments, which is really hardly explainable if you put aside paranoia and the political mindsets in the region. But there is also a share of responsibility on the shoulders of the EU, of the US, and the other major international partners. Clearly, no lessons have been drawn from the Arab Springs. There is this ill calculation in the name of stability, we need to support these governments and you know, not to make fuss about the widespread human rights violations, but actually, these governments are totally unsustainable, most of them, in the long run. And this policy keeps nurturing further extremism and a future destabilization. So indeed, the need for reform is absolutely urgent, not only for local civil societies in the region, but also for the sake of the stability in the region. And it's really high time the European Union and the U.S. Act on this.
Right. Steve, your note on the setback motion, what is your thinking?
Yeah, no, I mean, certainly from where I sit here in Bishkek, we've seen two deeply problematic bills advancing in the Kyrgyz parliament. Again, as we've all noted, Kyrgyzstan, the democratic exception of Central Asia, and still, despite, I think, a fairly robust response from local civil society, parliament and parts of the government plowing ahead with an anti-gay so-called propaganda bill, which would essentially silence anyone who seeks to share information about same-sex relations in Kyrgyzstan, and actually would propose criminal sanctions just for having a discussion about same-sex relations. And you also have a Russian-style copy-and-paste foreign agents bill, which would require organizations here that receive any foreign funds and engage in so-called political activity to register themselves as foreign agents, essentially become officially known as spies. And, you know, that is quite amazing, I think, to those of us that have been following Kyrgyzstan for a long time. And I don't think many of us could have expected that sort of deep deterioration in Kyrgyzstan's record. That is definitely a setback, I think, of the last few years, which has taken people by surprise. And it seems that the policy response in many of the Western capitals towards what's happening is slow and somewhat clumsy and not robust enough. In terms of setbacks in the rest of the region, definitely, as I noted, Tajikistan seems to also be, in a way, I had noted that I think, you know, for those of us that follow the whole region, the former Soviet Union, Azerbaijan is obviously experiencing a huge crackdown on civil society. Tajikistan also is, in a much lesser seen way, I think, is experiencing its own crackdown. They've also been discussing there a foreign agents bill recently. We noted what happened in the March elections. And we've also seen, you know, the detention and the holding incommunicado last summer of a blogger simply for looking into issues of conflict resolution in Gorno-Badakhshan. Of course, we've seen some very unexplained, uninvestigated violence in Gorno-Badakhshan. So those are definitely new setbacks in the more open republics. Of course, I noted Kazakhstan has been more on a steady decline in the last few years in terms of freedom of assembly. And in Uzbekistan, just last week, we saw, for example, probably one of the most brutal, most horrific attacks on a human rights defender that I've seen in a long time, which was the interrogation, the brutal treatment of Yelena Orlaeva, a human rights defender who courageously documents forced labor in Uzbekistan and is actually working on an issue that the government has even, you know, started in some way to own up to by working a little bit with the International Labor Organization to monitor child labor, maybe not adult forced labor. And Yelena Orlaeva was simply interviewing people who were being forced to go out into the fields and weed the cotton plant in preparation for the autumn cotton harvest. And she was detained, arrested, brutally treated, sexually humiliated. And, you know, as Johan said, the response of the West is lacking. There should be a robust response coming, not only condemning these attacks, but there should also be some very clear expectations set for all of the Central Asian governments about what benchmarks they have to meet. Central Asia should no longer be this exceptional area, this sort of exceptional, in a diplomatic sense, backwater, where authoritarianism and rights abuses are simply tolerated. They need to be held up to the same standards that apply to the rest of the world. And, you know, for that reason, at Human Rights Watch and other places, we're trying to think about more creative ways that these governments can be held accountable when they commit egregious human rights abuses. So we're looking at what the Human Rights Council can do on Uzbekistan. It could create a special rapporteur for the country. They should be finding ways to raise the profile of these quite egregious rights situations in the world.
Right. You have listed all these cases in length. In Turkmenistan, obviously, there is no independent NGO. There is no independent media at all to be talked about. And I also wanted to add that here. And Bradley, you want to say something?
I was just going to add that today, the lower house in Tajikistan actually voted supporting the new law on public associations. So it'll be strict monitoring of financial flows into the NGOs.
Oh, that's another item on the list. Bruce, jump in.
Yeah, I will too, because you just mentioned Turkmenistan. And at this point, I thought it was worth mentioning, since we're also talking about the fairly weak, if existent at all, Western response to this, that the OSCE Center in Ashgabat, of all places, and I'm quoting right off their page here, that the OSCE Center works on, it lists a bunch of things, security issues, but it ends with human rights, good governance, and rule of law issues, elections, and media freedom, and that's based in Ashgabat. Now, I don't want to say anything about these people's work, but I would have to say that so far I haven't seen many fruits from this. And so this is it. Now, the West can say we have an OSCE center in Ashgabat. Is it effective? I'm going to say no. It's my own personal opinion. But, so this is kind of the strange relationship the West has with Central Asia. As you know, the people say, well, you need to be more involved. You need to pressure them. And then they point to things like the OSCE Center in Ashgabat and saying, well, we're working with the local governments. But no one ever sees any progress from it. That's the problem.
Right. In the light of all these things, all these setbacks, the question is, what are the elements influencing for these changes, for these setbacks in the region? Obviously, there are external elements, and I believe there is also some internal elements. Steve, you want to jump in here?
Well, I mean, in some cases, I would agree with what Bruce said earlier about, you know, paranoia being at the root of the governance strategy of certainly the authoritarian leaders in the region. And, you know, when
it exists from last 24 years, isn't it? If we look at the recent setbacks that we have just, we've been talking in the show.
Right. No, I mean, I think it has existed for that time. But what I would say, though, is that in the case of Uzbekistan, let's say, the increasing closed nature of civil society, the isolation of activists, when I was there about 5 years ago doing research, activists would tell me, you know, the human rights situation has been poor for a long time, but what's changed is now there's literally no one left to witness. You know, there used to be, you know, there would be a whole smattering of NGOs that local activists could go to and could report to, and there, you know, there was some more of an echo chamber, let's say, on the ground, where organizations could, as they always do, form coalitions, group band together, raise concerns with the government, with the embassies, and make a little bit more noise, make it a little bit harder for authorities to abuse people. But now, I think, especially in Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan, where you have so little presence of sort of meaningfully and genuinely independent groups, international groups, reporters, it's so hard to get that information out quickly and verify it that, you know, I think silence just abets and enables deeper abuses.
Sorry, it was just to add on on this fact that there is no one left to witness. Indeed, in many of these countries, of course, pluralism has never been very significant. But still, for instance, in Kazakhstan, a couple of years ago, there used to be a couple of independent media, opposition media, and all of them were brutally closed down in 2012, 1 year after the Janosen riots by the government, which accused them of plotting the whole story. So, and the same happens basically across the region. In the end of last year, Uznews, one of the only independent news websites reporting on Uzbekistan, was forced to close down after the email of its editor in chief was hacked and which compromised the work of the company, and so now this media has ceased to exist. So, to a large extent, there was never real pluralism, but still there was one of two or three independent media outlets, and now even these ones have been forced to close down. And this only reinforces the silence which now prevails on what happens in these countries.
Right.
Can I jump in one more point on this in terms of, you know, Mohammed, you're trying to get at sort of what could be enabling these abuses. another theory on this that I have is that, you know, paradoxically, from the EU diplomats and U.S. diplomats often say that when they go hard on these governments, they alienate them, they push them back, and they may actually cause them to commit further abuses, which, of course, is a little legitimate concern that, you know, policymakers should think about. You know, will their demarches or their protests against human rights abuses cause further abuses? And, of course, no one wants that to happen. But I think, paradoxically, in the case of some of the worst abuses, say in Uzbekistan, when the EU sanctioned Uzbekistan, and when the U.S. put restrictions on military assistance going to Uzbekistan in the aftermath of the Andijan massacre, they actually attached to those sanctions criteria, very specific criteria for human rights improvements. And those criteria, in some way, they really held the line. They made it a little bit harder for the government to cross certain lines. So, for example, the International Committee of the Red Cross was still able to be inside the country during those very difficult years between Washington and Tashkent. Our office was still there. UzNews, as Johan discussed, was still there. You actually had a larger flow out of prison of political prisoners in those years than you do now. And, you know, when, in terms of the U.S., when the Obama administration came in and put more emphasis on the Northern Distribution Network and the importance of cooperating and using these transit lines through Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, obviously Manas, but also even Turkmenistan, they notably lessened the pressure on these governments. And I think that really did actually enable many of them to deepen abuses, to actually go in the opposite direction. So the engagement, which came with fewer principles attached, actually, I think, enabled deeper human rights abuses.
That's an interesting factor, Steve, just you pointed out. And then lately, there have been lots of things are happening in the region, too. I mean, the Ukraine crisis, one of us has just mentioned. Then there was the coalition prisons in Afghanistan. They just left. And then Chinese come back to the region. Is there any element other than a Western nation's passiveness, to say, in attaching conditions like respect to universal values to their agreements, relationships with those countries, which also might have contributed to these setbacks? Bruce?
Well, I would certainly name Putin's Russia as being a prime factor in here, and we see that with all these copycat laws that are being, if not passed, certainly considered in all these countries. In some cases, like Uzbekistan, most of this stuff has already been done a long time ago. But, you know, I mean, in Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan, of course, we got the laws against gay propaganda, the foreign agents laws, the, you know, on and on and on. And they're all reading off of Russia's playbook for this stuff. There's two things I want to mention, and I'll get out of this in a second. I agree with what Steve said about the U.S., like, lessening its pressure. And one of the examples I want to give about what this means to the people of the region, not so much the governments, but to the people of the region, is there were days when local people would have grievances against their government, and they would hold demonstrations outside the U.S. embassy, you know, essentially appealing to the American government to please help them take up their cause. And right before Andijan, for instance, there was, in 2005, there was a demonstration outside the U.S. embassy in Tashkent. Farmers from the south, is Bakadir Choriev's group, you know, and they were looking for support for the U.S. government. The only demonstrations outside the U.S. embassy in the last couple of years are anti-American demonstrations against U.S. policies in their region. Now, this shows that Russia has definitely stepped forward and dominated the political thinking of the people at this point. Now, to show that this is not totally hopeless, I would mention that the anti-gay law in Kazakhstan was shot down because they're bidding for the Olympics. So it is possible that international events and groups outside the country can affect certain laws within the country, as long as the government sees an interest in fulfilling these kind of demands. So Kazakhstan might not get the Winter Olympics in 2022, but if nothing else, it's delayed the passage of this odious law that they were considering. So it's not totally hopeless.
Turkmenistan is going to host international event in 2017. Let's see how international community can make the Turkmen president to accept some of his their demands. Here, again, want to go back to the to people in the region. In the face of all these changes, setbacks, how people are reacting to that? What's the reality on the ground, Steve?
Well, you know, we talk a lot to the people on the front lines, the human rights defenders, the journalists, and I would say, you know, in the most closed societies of Central Asia, they feel increasingly abandoned by the West. They feel disillusioned. They, you know, they need assistance. They urgently need help, as Johan has said too. I think, you know, of course, there's a younger generation coming up that is resilient. We see, you know, Uzbeks on social media in really large numbers discussing a lot of important issues. So we do see, you know, different approaches to human rights. People are, I think people are naturally always going to find ways to assert their concerns. But the picture is quite bleak overall. But I think what I'm inspired by is just, you know, the many courageous people like Yelena Orlaeva who go day after day into the storm and raise these issues. So as long as you have, you know, at least a few courageous voices like that, I think there is a lot of cause for hope and for optimism.
Right. You are sitting in the center of, you know, revolutions, I would say, Steve. There was a time when there were some kind of law being passed from the parliament, then people would come up to the street. Even I do not see that is happening in the face of all these changes in the Kyrgyz parliament lately. My question was how the crowd is reacting to all these changes, setbacks.
Well, you know, I mean, I think civil society here in Bishkek is quite sophisticated. I think, you know, a lot of the lobbying, a lot of the pushback maybe not be happening on the square, but it's certainly happening. It's certainly happening in the politician's office. It's happening in parliament. It's happening in different parts of Kyrgyzstan society. So, you know, I think some people feel that, you know, ultimately, perhaps hopefully, a lot of this lobbying has already reached the president's office. And he's heard in Brussels and he's heard here how little Kyrgyzstan really needs these laws. And so I think there's a fair amount of pressure coming from various parts of Kyrgyzstan's civil society against some of these deteriorating developments. So it may not be manifesting itself in the same way on the square. And, you know, I think that in large part also is due to some malaise with revolution and with the legacy of violence. I think people certainly are conscious of that past and want to avoid it. So, yeah, it's changed here in Kyrgyzstan. I think there's definitely been a maturing in a way of the way civil society raises its concerns.
Is there any possibility to change the situation? What is that? How it can be changed? I mean, there was a day when Kazakhstan was running the chairmanship of OSCE. Kyrgyzstan used to be called like haven of democracy or something,
the island of democracy.
Land of democracy. What is that? It can put the region back into that path. Can it happen? It's my final question, by the way. Johan?
Change can only happen in the inside, and it's as Steve mentioned, there are still seeds of hope in these activists and human rights defenders and independent journalists that keep fighting in more and more adverse circumstances for the respect of their rights and the rights of their fellow citizens. But probably the situation inside the countries is not isolated from the broader picture. We monitored, for instance, last year, a global decline in press freedom throughout the world, and for instance, the fact that Internet is more and more under control, even in the most stable democracies. The argument for extremism or terrorism is also ill used in many countries in the West and in other places. So what happens abroad, what happens in the rest of the world will also influence the situation inside, and probably also what happens in Ukraine. As you mentioned, the fact that the aftermath of the Ukraine crisis have also impacted the region and triggered to some extent setbacks, because some of the local leaders have been quite frightened of a potential revolution, or even if it's absolutely unlikely, but it has only nurtured their paranoia, and the Russian response, of course, has also nurtured their own paranoia. So the situation is also bound to the regional trends, and I don't believe that it may work in isolation. So it's also the responsibility once again to get back to the EU, to really rethink its engagement with the region at large, and even on its own respect for human rights and liberties, because it has an impact even on Central Asia.
Steve, Johan just touched the EU's engagement with Central Asia. Can the UN chief, who is in the region currently, can contribute to make this change happen? And in case of Turkmenistan, can EU do anything in its upcoming annual dialogue meeting, which to take place next week?
Absolutely, they can. I think, you know, one recollection I have of, you know, I think high-level diplomats, when they come to this region, they can do a lot just merely through their public statements. They can apply pressure. I mean, one of the lessons I think we see again and again is that pressure actually does work, even on these most authoritarian regimes. When Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State and she left the OSCE summit, I remember in Astana, and made her way to Tashkent, she made some public remarks. The day before getting to Tashkent, she said, "I will be raising the case of imprisoned human rights defenders with President Karimov when I see him." And literally the next day, I got a call, I was in Tashkent, that they had released a political prisoner named Farhod Mukhtarov. And it seemed like a very, very close causal relationship there between the statement and the pressure that came with that statement and the government's reaction. I do think that when Ban Ki-moon is meeting with these presidents, he should publicly and privately be raising all of these rights concerns, and as I said before, set benchmarks, make the calls for releases of specific political prisoners, lay out the laws that are specifically discriminatory. Don't speak in abstract terms about worsening levels of freedom of expression, but really be as specific as you can. I think that's one thing that he can do. That also applies to the EU. The EU, one of the main failings, I think, of the EU human rights dialogues with the Central Asian governments is that often they have these conversations. They occur in private, you know, to, I guess, encourage a more free-flowing exchange between the governments, which is understandable, but they should conclude those meetings with some sort of public expectation, some public statements. Well, what did we agree to? We agreed that you will release political dissidents, that you will allow a journalist from RFERL to work in Turkmenistan. That should be something that could actually be easily done in Brussels, is really changing the approach to the human rights dialogue to make them more effective. And, you know, again, on the UN, I really do hope that Ban Ki-moon raises the systematic non-cooperation by Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan with the human rights mechanisms of the UN. So that means that both of them, for many years now, have not let in so many of the special procedures, the UN special rapporteurs that focus on human rights. Just by allowing those experts to visit the country, we could gather a lot of information, which would, again, give us a basis to push for specific changes, and I think those processes do work. They do lead to some changes. So we've also seen that with the cotton campaign, that when over 170 apparel companies got together and started talking about the practice of forced labor in Uzbekistan's cotton sector, the government did eventually have to move and adjust and change its practices. So pressure works. I would leave it on that high note, and I think that Ban Ki-moon has his work cut out for him.
Bruce, final words. We started with you, and we end with you.
Yeah, I agree. Outside pressure won't hurt, and I think it's in the Western government's interest to understand that they have to deal with future generations too, and the people after the last few years have kind of given up hope on much help from the West, so it's time to rekindle that and show them that the West is serious. They are interested in people's problems out there, and they're willing to put some pressure on the government. You know, ultimately, I also agree with Johan that, you know, this is a question that the leadership in the countries are going to have to resolve, or at least they're going to have to start putting that into motion. And it's going to take a lot of courage, because you're going to have to fight with the entrenched elite, but you need to have someone who has a vision of their country 10, 20 years down the road as prosperous and a place where all people can express their own opinion and realize that there's a strength in that, you know, certainly in the case of Islamic extremists, they can't defeat that. People who are content with their life and support the governments are not going to be swayed to this kind of extremism. So, you know, everyone has to see that this is in their interest to support these kind of rights. Now, it's a seed that you plant that doesn't bear fruit immediately, but down the road you can harvest big time.
All right. Thank you, Bruce. Thank you very much, guests. from Bishkek, Steve Severtlou, Human Rights Watch Central Asia Director, Johan Beer from Paris, European Central Asia Director at Reporters Without Borders. Bradley James Jardine was here. He kept silent, mostly. Thank you very much for being a part of the discussion. And I am Mohammed Tahir, Director of Turkmenistan Service. It has been fascinating discussion, as always.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.